period of reorganization, being available day or night to help out. It also meant occasionally letting another person take credit for a job well done. To shine at service, we need to monitor the satisfaction of customers, not waiting to hear complaints, but freely offering information that might be helpful without self-interest motivating the gesture. This lays the groundwork for a trusting relationship, one where the client or coworker will feel a positive regard and start to see us as a source of reliable and helpful information, elevating the relationship above one simply of buyer and seller. That, of course, takes empathy. Consider the results from a study of the sales force of an office supply and equipment company that sells to industrial organizations and government agencies. The most successful members of the sales force were able to combine taking the customer's viewpoint with appropriate assertiveness to steer them toward a choice that satisfied both their needs. If a salesperson takes too much control, it can lead to resentment. Successful salespeople empathize at the outset of the interaction, sensing the buyer's viewpoint, and fine-tuning their sense of what the buyer wants as the interaction continues. For instance, noting signs of discomfort in response to a suggestion and expressing empathic concern before going on. The shift toward making the customer's needs the center of the relationship goes hand in glove with having a friendly emotional tone. This is crucial in handling disgruntled customers. A customer was having some difficulty getting a refund check, a manager in a large retail store recalls. She came to me because she said our operations manager was rude to her. I'm sure that was just a misunderstanding, but I apologized, helped her get the check, and sent her on her way. It took only a few minutes to straighten out the problem, and she left feeling better than when she came in. That last line bears repeating. She left feeling better than when she came in. How customers feel when they interact with an employee determines how they feel about the company itself. In a psychological sense, the company, as experienced by the customer, is these interactions. Loyalty is lost or strengthened in every interaction between a company and its customers. To paraphrase business maven Peter Drucker, the purpose of business is not to make a sale, but to make and keep a customer. The costs of cost-cutting. Nancy Cohen walked into a Pier 1 store intending to buy a new set of kitchen chairs. The store had the chairs, but she walked out empty-handed and furious. I was pre-sold, she told a colleague of mine, but I couldn't get anyone to help me. The sales help were too busy chatting among themselves. I said to the woman who finally faced me, I am interested in the chairs in the window. Do you have any in stock, and do you have any other colors? The reply, a vague gesture to a corner of the store filled with glassware, and the even vaguer, almost mystifying response, I think it comes in that color. And with that, the saleswoman walked away from an $800 sale. That sales clerk was absolutely incompetent at customer service, the critical ability for anyone who works at the interface between a company and its clientele. And such incompetence is on the rise in American department and discount stores. A 1996 survey of 4,000 consumers by Yankelevich Partners rated such retailers 11th out of 20 consumer services, behind telephone companies, restaurants, and even the U.S. Post Office. One villain seems to be too sharply reduced staffing on sales floors. Another, curtailing training. The American retail industry now spends less on training salespeople than any other business. One of the worst signs of incompetence at customer service is an us-against-them mindset, where the customer or client is targeted as an enemy and viewed only as someone to be manipulated. This stance hampers salespeople's effectiveness at selling because they don't really see the customer. This can lead to a misguided hard sell, where a salesperson comes on too strong in a way that is utterly at odds with the customer's needs. Leveraging diversity, cultivating opportunities through different kinds of people. People with this competence respect and relate well to people from varied backgrounds, understand diverse worldviews, and are sensitive to group differences. See diversity as opportunity, creating an environment where diverse people can thrive. Challenge bias and intolerance. I often tell the story about my encounter with an outgoing bus driver in New York City, who managed to keep up an upbeat patter with his passengers as he navigated the streets of the city. By the time people got off that bus, their bad moods had been lifted by exposure to his sheer exuberance. It was a breathtaking demonstration of social adeptness. I used to describe the bus driver as a black man around 60. But after one lecture, an African-American woman came up and challenged me. "Why did you mention he was black? Would you have mentioned it if he had been Jewish or Japanese?" I was stunned by her question. Thinking it over, I realized that, for me, mentioning the bus driver's race was implicitly part of a rejoinder I was making to the book The Bell Curve, which had argued that IQ is the key to life success, and that African-Americans had a disadvantage relative to other groups in this area. In my analysis, the book was based on flawed data, and besides, IQ was but one part of a spectrum of factors that led to life success, with emotional intelligence playing a major role. I wanted to make the point that this African-American man was gifted in that domain. But the woman retorted that I hadn't made any of that explicit, and to her ears, I seemed to be describing someone who gets along by being overly eager to please white people. At any rate, his race was irrelevant, she argued. And she was right. In the context in which I told the story, the man's race was irrelevant. To call attention to his race was to raise a difference that was beside the point. I dropped any mention of his race from then on. Calling attention to someone's group affiliation when that identity is irrelevant can invoke a stereotype about that group in the minds of all concerned. And group stereotypes can have an emotional power that negatively affects performance. The destructive power of stereotypes, particularly for members of minority groups in an organization, has been revealed in an elegant series of studies by Claude Steele, a psychologist at Stanford University. Steele should know. He's one of very few African-American members of that university's mostly white faculty. While Steele's experiments dealt with academic performance, the implications for the workplace are direct. Negative stereotypes can cripple work performance. To be successful on a job, people need to feel they belong there and are accepted and valued, and that they have the skills and inner resources needed to achieve, even prosper. When negative stereotypes undermine these assumptions, they hamper performance. Stereotype threat is the term Steele coined to refer to a kind of emotional landmine, an expectation of low performance that, though unspoken, permeates an organization, creating an atmosphere that negatively affects someone's work abilities. Such expectations have the potential to cause levels of anxiety that seriously impair cognitive ability. As we saw in Chapter 5, the aroused amygdala can shrink the space available in working memory, and stereotype threat is certainly capable of activating the amygdala. A threat in the air. The test Steele devised was straightforward enough. College men and women who were strong in math were asked to solve problems taken from the qualifying exam for graduate school. They took the test in two groups. The first group was told that the test usually showed differences in ability between men and women. The others were told nothing. The women's scores on the test were appreciably lower than the men's, but only when they had been told the test was sensitive to gender differences. The women who had not been reminded about gender issues did just as well as the men. The same performance-lowering effect occurred when black test takers were given a similarly threatening message. Steele's experiments offer dramatic evidence of the power of even suggesting stereotypes. The active ingredient in lowering the women's scores, Steele found, was debilitating anxiety. Though they had the potential to perform well, the anxiety triggered by the threatening stereotype impaired their performance. Steele contends that this anxiety is worsened by the interpretive framework the stereotype creates. The usual anxieties of a challenging task are seen as confirming that they cannot perform, which amplifies their own anxieties, so they do indeed perform poorly. Those most likely to feel the effects of stereotype threat are those at the vanguard of a group, the first women to become jet pilots, say, or the first minority group member to enter a law firm or brokerage house. Despite having the skills and self-confidence to enter this new territory, once there, they can feel the full effect of stereotype threat, and so, for the first time, may experience emotionally induced performance lapses. Women who are at the higher reaches of executive ranks offer a case in point. A survey of women and their CEOs revealed that the CEOs believed women's lack of management experience and tenure was what prevented them from advancing to corporate leadership positions. The women executives, though, named as the number one and two reasons, stereotyping and exclusion from informal networks in the organization. The stereotype threat for women executives seems to come into play in specific circumstances. A review of 61 studies on workplace prejudice against women managers found that bias comes into play most when women work in jobs that traditionally have been held by men, or are evaluated by men rather than women. How stereotypes threaten. Steele argues that stereotype threat may be one reason women are underrepresented in math, engineering, and the physical sciences. While American girls show no difference from boys in math abilities through elementary and middle school, once they enter high school, their scores on math tests start to lag, and the gap widens through college and graduate school. At the start of their college careers, women drop out of math, science, and engineering programs at 2.5 times the rate of men. American women earn just 22% of college degrees in these fields, and only 13% of the PhDs, and hold just 10% of the jobs, where, incidentally, they earn only 3/4 of the salary paid to men in comparable positions. This failure to perform has nothing to do with skill. It has much to do with the presence of disabling stereotypes. Steele points to instances of underperformance by blacks and women, despite high test scores, as evidence for the role of emotional threat once people enter a domain where a threatening stereotype exists. At that point, he argues, people are particularly vulnerable to doubting their own abilities, questioning their talents and skills, thus undermining their own sense of capability. Their anxiety acts as a spotlight, both for themselves and, at least in their minds, those who are watching to see how well or how poorly they will do. Black students, for example, are affected by rumors of inferiority, such as those put forth in the book The Bell Curve. That same kind of wrong thinking afflicts oppressed minorities around the world. Through long exposure, such negative social stereotypes take hold, Steele argues, and so intimidate those who belong to such groups. That intimidation becomes emotionally potent and destructive in the workplace. Success through others. One of the watchwords at the Harvard Business School these days is success through others who are different from yourself. There is strength in difference, and this makes the ability to leverage diversity an increasingly crucial competence. The vastly greater variety of people working in organizations of every kind demands a greater awareness of the subtle distortions that stereotypes and bias bring to working relationships. Among managers, for example, being able to read people accurately without the distortions of emotionally laden stereotypes sets superior performers apart from average. We generally have difficulty reading the subtle nonverbal signals of emotion in those who belong to groups very different from our own, whether a different gender, race, nationality, or ethnic group. Every group has its own norms for expressing emotion, and to the extent we are unfamiliar with those norms, empathizing grows more difficult. As we have seen, a failure of empathy can throw any interaction off key, making both people uncomfortable and creating an emotional distance, which in turn encourages us to view the other person through the lens of a group stereotype rather than see him or her as an individual. The missing ingredient in many diversity programs is that they fail to take advantage of diversity by using it to help participants learn how to do their business better. It's all well and good to make people of diverse backgrounds feel comfortable and welcome at work, but we can go further, leveraging diversity to heighten performance across the board. Beyond zero tolerance for intolerance, the ability to leverage diversity revolves around three skills: getting along well with people who are different, appreciating the unique ways others may operate, and seizing whatever business opportunity these unique approaches might offer. These principles point the way to what David Thomas and Robin Ely contend in a Harvard Business Review article, can be the potential benefits of leveraging diversity: heightened profitability, enhanced organizational learning, flexibility, and rapid adaptation to shifting markets. To go that extra step requires questioning the widespread assumption that the only goal of diversification is simply to raise the numbers of different kinds of people in a workforce, channeling them to jobs specializing in dealing with customers like themselves. This assumes, Thomas and Ely argue, that the main special contribution minority group members can make to a company is in using their insider sensibility to help the company market better to members of their group. That is a decent goal so far as it goes, but it fails to reap the true benefits of diversity. Thomas and Ely propose that diverse people bring different, important, and competitively relevant knowledge and perspectives about how to actually do work, how to design processes, reach goals, frame tasks, create effective teams, communicate ideas, and lead. And this knowledge can improve an organization. Consider the case of a public interest law firm in the northeastern United States. In the 1980s, the law firm's all-white staff became concerned that their main clients, women in workplace disputes, were also all-white. They felt obligated to diversify their client base. So the firm hired an Hispanic lawyer, hoping she would bring in Hispanic clients. But something more happened. She brought in a new way of thinking about the basic business of the law firm itself. One result was that the firm expanded its practice beyond women's issues, also pursuing precedent-setting litigation challenging English-only policies. As the firm began to take on more non-white lawyers, says one of its principal partners, it affected our work by expanding our notions of what are relevant issues and framing them in creative ways that would never have been done with an all-white staff. It's really changed the substance, and in that sense enhanced the quality of our work. When leaders of organizations value the insights brought to work by people of diverse backgrounds, it can lead to organizational learning that boosts competitiveness. Take a financial services company whose sales model had focused on rapid-fire cold calls until it realized that its most successful salespeople were women who used the sales approach more in keeping with their gender style, the slow, sure building of relationships. This company now takes a more flexible approach to sales, encouraging and rewarding the differing styles that work better for salespeople of different backgrounds. The company was able to use the insight offered by the women's success to question its own assumptions, learn, and change, and so do better by leveraging diversity. Political awareness, reading social and political currents. People with this competence accurately read key power relationships, detect crucial social networks, understand the forces that shape views and actions of clients, customers, or competitors, accurately read organizational and external realities. An outstanding diplomat tells of being posted to an oil-rich African nation and quickly learning that it was the Prime Minister's executive assistant's mistress's nephew who actually called the shots on that nation's petroleum policy. So the diplomat immediately arranged to get invited to a party where he could meet, befriend, and eventually lobby the nephew. The ability to read political realities is vital to the behind-the-scenes networking and coalition building that allows someone to wield influence, no matter what their professional role. Mediocre performers lack such social acumen, and so betray a distressingly low level of political savvy. A director of training and development at a Fortune 500 company asked me to help design a program for managers there, because, as she candidly put it, "You can describe many of the managers here as practically unconscious, oblivious to what's going on around them." Every organization has its own invisible nervous system of connection and influence. Some people are oblivious to this below-the-radar world, while others have it fully on their own screen. Skill at reading the currents that influence the real decision-makers depends on the ability to empathize on an organizational level, not just an interpersonal one. People who maintain rich personal networks in an organization typically are savvy about what is going on, and this social intelligence extends to understanding the larger realities that affect the organization. For example, Knowing how to read the currents in the client organization typifies people outstanding in corporate sales. One politically savvy star performer gave this example. An executive VP, who was relatively new on the board, was a rising star and a favorite son of the president of the corporation we sell to. He was really the decision maker. He had carte blanche from the president. We found that fostering a relationship with him was very much to our benefit and the key to the sale. Outstanding performers in most organizations share this ability. Among managers and executives generally, this emotional competence distinguishes superior performers. Their ability to read situations objectively, without the distorting lens of their own biases or assumptions, allows them to respond effectively. And the further up the organizational ladder, the more this matters. Executives continually are put in the predicament of having to balance seemingly conflicting points of view or interests, whether from within or from the world at large. Without this political astuteness, managers are at a loss to balance the multitudinous perspectives of peers, bosses, subordinates, customers, and competitors. People who do this well are able to distance themselves a bit, setting aside their own emotional involvement in events to see with more objectivity. For example, when faced with a conflict within their organization, they can take multiple perspectives, describing with some accuracy the position of each person involved. This is true despite the fact that all of us encounter few events, especially emotionally loaded ones, about which we have no opinion or feeling. This emotional competence builds on both emotional self-control and empathy, allowing people to see clearly rather than be swayed by their own point of view. Political savvy. The vice chairman of a large American oil company went to China during the rule of Deng Xiaoping. While there, he gave a talk to a small group of Chinese officials and made some comments critical of President Clinton. His audience sat listening in a frozen silence, and when he finished, no one said a word. The next day, someone came to the offices of the oil company to apologize, saying with some delicacy, "We are sorry we were not able to carry on a conversation in a more interactive way yesterday, but you understand that many of the topics your vice chairman brought up are foreign to us." The employee who received the message said later, "I considered them very gracious. What they did not say to my face was, 'Your vice chairman can criticize Clinton and feel that's okay. But if one of us did the same thing to our head of state, he'd probably be in jail the next day.'" The oil company vice chairman lacked sensitivity to the ground rules of the culture he was dealing with. And, as with national cultures, every organization has its implicit ground rules for what is acceptable and what is not. Empathizing at the organizational level means being attuned to the climate and culture of an organization. The inevitable politics of organizational life create competing coalitions and power struggles. A sensitivity to these political fault lines of alliance and rivalry makes a person more understanding of the underlying issues and better able to address what really matters to key decision makers. At an even higher level of competence, this awareness extends to the larger forces in the world, competitive or regulatory pressures, technological opportunities, political forces, and the like, that determine the global opportunities and constraints of the organization. A caution. While political animals, those who live to play the game of organizational politics in pursuit of their own interest and advancement, eagerly study the invisible web of power, their weakness lies in the fact that their motive for doing so is pure self-interest. They ignore information that does not bear on their personal agenda, and this can create blind spots. It also means they tune out the feelings of those around them, except when pertinent to their own ambition. And so political animals often come across as uncaring, insensitive, and self-centered. Disdain of, or disinterest in, organizational politics is also a liability. Whatever the reason, those who lack political astuteness more often blunder in trying to mobilize others to their cause because their attempts at influence are misdirected or inept. An accurate understanding of the formal structure of the organizational chart is not enough. What's needed is a keen sense of the informal structure and the unspoken power centers in the organization. Chapter 8, The Arts of Influence. The merger of Salomon Brothers and Smith Barney created one of the world's largest financial firms. In the business press, the event was heralded as a crowning achievement of Smith Barney's CEO, Sanford Sandy Weill, who engineered the merger and who months later would go on to yet another with Citicorp. Within weeks of the announcement, a series of meetings were held throughout the two firms, detailing just how the two heavyweight companies would morph into a single giant. And, as is usually the case in such mergers, hundreds of employees would lose their jobs, since many functions were duplicated between the companies. But how can that news be delivered without rendering this already worrisome reality all the more so? One department head did it in the worst way. He gave a gloomy, even menacing speech, saying essentially, "I don't know what I'm going to do, but don't expect me to be nice to you. I have to fire half the people here, and I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to make that decision. So I'd like each of you to tell me your background and qualifications so I can start." His counterpart at the other company did much better. His message was upbeat. "We think this new company will be a very exciting platform for our work, and we're blessed with talented people from both organizations to work with. We'll make our decisions as quickly as we can, but not until we're positively sure we've collected enough information to be fair. We'll update you every few days on how we're doing. And we'll decide both on the basis of objective performance data plus qualitative abilities like teamwork." Those in the second group, Mark Lohr, a managing director at Salomon Smith Barney, told me, became more productive because they were excited about the potential, and they knew even if they didn't end up with a job, it would be a fair decision. But in the first group, he observed, everyone was unmotivated. They heard, "I'm not being treated fairly," and it triggered a collective amygdala attack. They were bitter, demoralized. People were saying, "I don't know if I even want to work for this jerk anymore, let alone the company." Headhunters connected with his people and recruited some of the best away, but not those in the other group. Said Lohr, "When Lehman didn't fully integrate Shearson, when they merged, there was a massive failure. But when Smith Barney took over Shearson, they were able to make it work. It's how you treat people immediately after the merger that makes all the difference. It allows the roots of trust between the two cultures to start growing. Sandy Weill's genius is his ability to integrate firms quickly so they don't die." The art of influence entails handling emotions effectively in other people. Both department heads were, in this sense, influential, but in opposite ways. Star performers are artful at sending emotional signals, and so are powerful communicators, able to sway an audience. In short, leaders. Emotions are contagious. All these abilities take advantage of a primal fact. We influence each other's moods. Influencing another person's emotional state, for better or worse, is perfectly natural. We do it constantly, catching emotions from one another like some kind of social virus. This emotional exchange constitutes an invisible interpersonal economy, part of every human interaction, but it is usually too subtle to notice. Even so, the transmission of mood is remarkably powerful. When three strangers, all volunteers for a study of moods, sat quietly in a circle for 2 minutes, the most emotionally expressive person transmitted his or her mood to the two others over the course of the 2 minutes. In every such session, the mood the most expressive person had going in was also the mood the other two felt coming out, whether happy, bored, anxious, or angry. Emotions are contagious. As the Swiss psychoanalyst C.G. Jung put it, in psychotherapy, even if the doctor is entirely detached from the emotional contents of the patient, the very fact that the patient has emotions has an effect upon him. And it is a great mistake if the doctor thinks he can lift himself above it. He cannot do more than become conscious of the fact that he is affected. If he does not see that, he is too aloof and then misses the point. What holds in the intimate exchange of psychotherapy is no less true on the shop floor, in the boardroom, or in the emotional hothouse of office life. We transmit moods between us with such ease because they can be vital signs for survival. Our emotions tell us what to focus on, when to be ready to act. Emotions are attention grabbers, operating as warnings, invitations, alarms, and the like. These are powerful messages, conveying crucial information without necessarily putting that data into words. Emotions are a hyper-efficient mode of communication. In a primitive human band, emotional contagion, the spread from person to person of fear, presumably acted as an alarm signal, quickly focusing everyone's attention on an immediate danger, like a stalking tiger. Today, that same collective mechanism operates whenever word spreads of an alarming drop in sales, a coming wave of layoffs, or a new threat from a competitor. Each person in the chain of communication activates the same underlying emotional state in the next, and so passes on the message to be alert. Emotions as a signaling system need no words, a fact evolutionary theorists see as one reason emotions may have played such a crucial role in the development of the human brain, long before words became a symbolic tool for humans. This evolutionary legacy means that our radar for emotions attunes us to those around us, helping us interact more smoothly and effectively. The emotional economy is the sum total of the exchanges of feeling among us. In subtle or not so subtle ways, we all make each other feel a bit better or a lot worse as part of any contact we have. Every encounter can be weighted along a scale from emotionally toxic to nourishing. While its operation is largely invisible, this economy can have immense benefits for a business or for the tone of organizational life. The group heart. A group of managers are negotiating how to distribute a limited amount of bonus money. Each presents a worthy candidate from his or her own department, making the arguments for what size bonus each candidate will get. It's a discussion that can turn acrimonious or end in harmony, depending. Depending on what? It turns out what makes the difference are the moods that spread among the managers as they talk. The moods people catch from each other at work are a crucial, yet often unnoticed, ingredient in how well they work. One dramatic, scientific demonstration of how the emotions rippling through a group can impact performance was done by Segal Barshadeh, a professor at the Yale University School of Management. A group of volunteers from the business school were brought together to act the part of managers allocating bonuses. Each volunteer had two goals: to get as large a bonus as possible for their candidate, and to help the committee as a group make the best use of the pool of funds for the company as a whole. What they did not know was that among them was a plant who had been coached by Barshadeh. A trained actor, this manager always went first and always made identical arguments. But he did it in one of four emotional keys: with cheerful, ebullient enthusiasm, with a relaxed, serene warmth, with a depressed sluggishness, or with an unpleasant and hostile irritability. His real role was to infect the group with one or another of these emotional states, like spreading a virus among unknowing victims. The emotions did spread like a virus. When the actor argued with cheerfulness or warmth, those feelings rippled through the group, making people more positive as the meeting went on. And when he was irritable, people felt grumpier. Depression, on the other hand, spread little, perhaps because it manifests as a subtle social withdrawal, indicated, for instance, by little eye contact, and so has little amplification. Good feelings spread more powerfully than bad ones, and the effects were extremely salutary, boosting cooperation, fairness, collaboration, and overall group performance. The improvement was more than just a glow from good feelings. Objective measures showed the groups were more effective, in this case, better able to distribute the bonus money fairly and in ways that would most benefit the company. In the world of work, no matter the business at hand, emotional elements play a crucial role. Emotional competence requires being able to pilot through the emotional undercurrents always at play, rather than being pulled under by them. handling the other person's emotions. It's the end of a long, tiring, muggy day at Walt Disney World, and a busload of parents and children are starting the 20-minute ride back to their hotel. The children are overstimulated and cranky, and so are the parents. Everyone is whiny. It's a bus ride from hell. Then, rising above the miasmic drone of complaining children and parents, comes a thin, persistent warble. The bus driver has started to sing the song, Under the Sea, from the movie The Little Mermaid. Everyone begins to quiet down and listen. Eventually, a little girl chimes in, then several more children. By the end of the ride, everyone is singing The Circle of Life from the movie The Lion King. The bus ride from hell has become the pleasurable, song-filled end to a full day. That bus driver knew just what he was doing. In fact, the singing drivers are part of an intentional strategy to help keep customers mellow. I still remember with some delight the driver of a Mickey Mouse bus breaking into the theme song for the then-popular Mickey Mouse Club TV show when I visited Disneyland as a child way back in the 1950s. It remains the most vivid memory of that holiday trip. This strategy takes clever advantage of emotional contagion. We are all part of each other's emotional toolkits, for better or worse. We continually prime others' emotional states, just as they do ours. This fact offers a powerful argument against the uninhibited expression of toxic feelings at work. They poison the well. On the flip side, our positive feelings about a company are to a large extent based on how the people that represent the organization make us feel. The most effective people in organizations know this innately. They naturally use their emotional radar to sense how others are reacting, and they fine-tune their own response to push the interaction in the best direction. As Tom Pritzker, president of Hyatt Hotels, told me, the lady at the front desk who wins over the customer with her smile can't be quantified, but you can sense the advantage. It happens that smiles are the most contagious emotional signal of all, having an almost irresistible power to make other people smile in return. And smiling in and of itself primes positive feelings. The same brain mechanisms that underlie empathy and allow for emotional attunement also create the pathway for emotional contagion. But in addition to the circuitry emanating from the amygdala, the basal areas, including the brainstem, which regulate reflexive, automatic functions, are also involved. These areas operate to create a tight loop of biological connectiveness, recreating in one person the physiological state of the other. And this seems to be a pathway emotions follow in traveling from one person to another. This is the system at work when someone is skilled at swaying an audience. As Howard Friedman, a psychologist at the University of California at Irvine, observes, the essence of eloquent, passionate, spirited communication seems to involve the use of facial expressions, voices, gestures, and body movements to transmit emotions. Friedman's research shows that people who have this emotional adeptness are better able to move and inspire others and to captivate their imagination. In a sense, emotional display is like theater. We all have a backstage, the hidden zone where we feel our emotions, and a stage front, the social arena where we present the emotions we choose to reveal. This private split between our public and private emotional lives is analogous to the concept of the front of the store and the back office. Emotional displays are more often carefully stage-managed when interacting with customers and less well-managed backstage, and this discrepancy can be unfortunate. As one organizational consultant put it, many an executive who appears highly charismatic out of the office comes back and acts like a jerk with his employees. Or, as the director of a large Sunday school complained to me about her minister, he's just too impassive, completely unexpressive. He's so hard to read, I don't know how to take much of what he says to me. It's very difficult to work with him. Being poor at managing and appropriately expressing emotions can be a major handicap. Social skills, in the essential sense of handling another person's emotions artfully, underlie several competencies. These include influence, wielding effective tactics of persuasion. Communication, sending clear and convincing messages. conflict management, negotiation and resolving disagreements. Leadership, inspiring and guiding. Change catalyst, initiating, promoting, or managing change. Influence, wielding effective tactics for persuasion. People with this competence are skilled at winning people over. Fine-tune presentations to appeal to the listener. Use complex strategies like indirect influence to build consensus and support. Orchestrate dramatic events to effectively make a point. A representative of an American company in Tokyo was taking his visiting boss to a series of meetings with their Japanese counterparts. On the way to the first meeting, the representative, who spoke Japanese fluently, advised his American boss not to ask him to translate in front of the Japanese, but to rely instead on the translator. His boss readily agreed. Why? "They'll think I'm just a mouthpiece to send things back to New York. I wanted to make sure they saw me as having real power to make decisions on the spot. I wanted to be seen as the person who did most of the talking. I had the answers, not New York." That sensitivity to the impact of such a seemingly trivial matter bespeaks competence at influence. At the most basic level, influence and persuasion hinge on arousing specific emotions in the other person, whether that be respect for our power, passion for a project, enthusiasm for outdoing a competitor, or appropriate outrage over some unfairness. People adept at influence are able to sense or even anticipate their audience's reaction to their message and can effectively carry everyone along toward an intended goal. Star performers at Deloitte and Touche Consulting, for example, know that a simple good argument may not be enough to win clients over, and they have the ability to sense what kinds of other appeals will persuade key decision makers. Critical in these skills is being able to notice when logical arguments are falling flat and when appeals that are more emotional may add impact. This emotional competence emerges over and over as a hallmark of superior performers, particularly among supervisors, managers, and executives. At every level, however, a sophisticated understanding of influence is called for. In entry-level positions, being too highly power-driven and overly concerned with having an impact can trip you up, especially if you try to put on airs and take on the trappings of power, Richard Boyatzis tells me. If you were just made sales manager and you try to impress people by imposing distance or by feigning status, you start wearing expensive three-piece suits or tell subordinates to stop calling you by your first name, for example, you can alienate people. The stratagems used by top performers include impression management, appeals to reason and facts, dramatic arguments or actions, building coalitions and behind-the-scenes support, emphasizing key information, and on and on. For instance, one outstanding manager was put in charge of quality control at a large manufacturer. The first thing he did was to change the name to Quality Services, a subtle but crucial shift of emphasis. The image I wanted to create was that it's not just a policeman organization, but it provides technical input too. Now we have an iron grip on tracking down quality complaints from customers, and the production people don't get defensive right away. Dramatic action can capture attention and arouse emotion. If well done, this is among the most effective of influence strategies. Dramatic does not necessarily mean having flashy visuals in presentations. Sometimes the effect is felt through the most prosaic means. One outstanding salesman wowed a prospective account by spending the better part of a day with his sleeves rolled up, using one of his products to fix a piece of equipment that had been purchased from a competitor. What got him the account was his dramatic demonstration of the level of service his prospective client could expect. As he put it, they were amazed. First, build rapport. Empathy is crucial for wielding influence. It is impossible to have a positive impact on others without first sensing how they feel and understanding their position. People who are poor at reading emotional cues and inept at social interactions are very poor at influence. The first step in influence is building rapport. For a business analyst at a global American oil company, that meant changing the way he approached the representatives of a South American bank. He said, I have a lot of funds going back and forth, and the bank plays an important role. And in South America, friendship ties mean a lot when you're doing business. I wanted to be able to call a commercial rep and say, Hey, I've got a problem, and have them be willing to work with us to get our work done. His tactic? A long, leisurely meeting over coffee with several key representatives, where they talked about themselves, their families, their lives, not just business. Similarly, a manufacturer's rep tells me, When you walk into a customer's office, the first thing you do is scan the room to pick up on something he's enthusiastic and excited about. That's where you start the conversation. His approach takes for granted that building rapport necessarily precedes persuasion. As one outstanding salesman put it, sometimes it means I go in without a briefcase and say, Hey, how you doing today? Want a hot dog from the guy across the street? Let's go out and get it together. And I know that if I'm going to call on the man in the jeans and the flannel shirt, I won't wear my three-piece suit. Similar persuasion skills are seen in the executive who is trying to recruit someone to take a job that requires moving to another city. He knows the prospect loves sailing, and so shows her the local marina. Or he capitalizes on the prospect's spouse's love of riding by introducing him to friends who are equestrians, so that he will be on board for the move too. Persuasion is lubricated by identifying a bond or commonality. Taking time to establish one is not a detour, but an essential step. An announcement made by a remote and largely invisible CEO may have less immediate persuasive power than the same message delivered by someone workers have day-to-day contact with. One strategy for spreading change in a large and far-flung organization, then, is to use networks of local leaders, the individuals within a working group that everyone knows, likes, and respects. At the highest levels of effectiveness, the influential rely on indirect strategies so that their hand is virtually invisible. They have a third party make the crucial argument, establishing chains of influence. They set up effective behind-the-scenes coalitions for support, or shape the presentation of information in subtle ways so that everyone easily and fluidly arrives at the desired consensus. The rule of thumb is that consensus building is crucial, but this is ignored to a surprising degree. In a study of strategic decisions at 356 American companies, more than half were never adopted, were implemented only partially, or were abandoned at the outset. The single most common reason for the failure of these plans was that the lead executives were imperious, trying to impose their ideas instead of building a supporting consensus. When the imperious approach was employed, 58% of the time the result was failure. But when executives first conferred with colleagues to rethink their long-term priorities, strategic plans were adopted 96% of the time. As Paul McNutt, the Ohio State University professor of management who did the study, says, If you involve people in at least some of the steps of the process, they will become missionaries for you. The failure to convince. The benefit was for a good cause. A new preschool for children of poor, single working mothers. A local artist of some national prominence had invited about 100 friends to a special show of her newest work, and a buffet dinner contributed by several local restaurants. After the meal, the hostess gathered everyone together on the lawn and introduced the head of the organization that ran the preschool, who began with a detailed rundown of the events in her life that led her to take her present job. Then she gave a blow-by-blow account of how the preschool got started. After that, she proceeded to run through the entire history of the preschool in what turned out to be excruciating detail. A talk that might have been effective, had it lasted for 10 minutes, went on for almost an hour, and she hadn't even introduced some mothers and teachers, each of whom was going to say a few words. The audience, all sympathetic from the beginning, began to drift off. Dusk had arrived, and with it, swarming mosquitoes. Finally, the hostess's husband, a somewhat cantankerous older gentleman, got up conspicuously, ambled straight for the cake table, and bellowed, Too much detail! The cakes are falling! With that, all semblance of an attentive audience collapsed, and everyone headed for dessert. People who, despite their good intentions, fail to connect emotionally with their audience fall at the bottom of the influence competence hierarchy. They may mean well, but they lack the means to get their message across. The blunt critique by the hostess's husband captured the mood of the audience at that moment far better than the speech by the long-winded schoolhead. Those who rely too heavily on the persuasive effects of aids, such as elaborate overhead projections or eloquent statistical analyses of data, also can miss the boat. An audience must be emotionally engaged, but mediocre presenters rarely go beyond the same dry litany of facts, however flashily displayed, and never take into account the emotional temperature of the audience. Without an accurate reading of how a listener is taking in an idea, that idea is in danger of falling on deaf, indifferent, or even hostile ears. No matter how intellectually brilliant we may be, that brilliance will fail to shine if we are not persuasive. That is particularly true in fields where entry has high hurdles for cognitive abilities, like engineering and science, medicine and law, and executive ranks in general. As the director of research at one of Wall Street's largest brokerage firms put it to me, "To get into our business, you need to be highly adept at numbers. But to make things happen, that's just not enough. You have to be able to persuade." Signs of weakness in the ability to persuade include failure to build a coalition or get buy-in, over-reliance on a familiar strategy instead of choosing the best one for the moment, bull-headed promotion of a point of view, no matter the feedback, being ignored or failing to inspire interest, having a negative impact. The Machiavellian manipulator. For him, appearance was all. He married a woman from a noble family, and he himself was extremely polished socially. As a highly placed manager in a German industrial dynasty, he was in charge of a division with revenues of more than $1 billion annually. But on the job, he focused all his considerable charm upward toward his own boss, and outward to impress those who met him. When it came to those who reported to him, he was a petty tyrant mistreating his serfs. When you met him, he could be quite beguiling, but people who worked for him were afraid of him, I was told by an outside consultant who was hired to do an impartial appraisal of the manager. He had no respect for the people under him. If there was low performance, he shouted at people. If high, he said nothing. He demoralized his subordinates. His CEO finally asked him to leave, but because he makes such a good first impression, he landed another high-level job immediately. The slick German manager exemplifies a type who can thrive in organizations that are more politically oriented than performance oriented. Such people are effective upward, but poor downward, because they don't really care, the consultant told me. They are often self-centered, don't like people, and feel an obligation only to themselves, not to the organization. Charm and social polish in themselves do not add up to competence at influence. Social skill in the service of oneself, and to the detriment of the group as a whole, is sooner or later recognized as a charade. True influence as a positive competence is very different from a Machiavellian drive for personal success at all costs. The power exhibited in the influence competence is socialized and harmonious with the collective goal, rather than exclusively for selfish gain. As one analyst of influence in close to 300 organizations put it, "We have not found the best performers pursuing their own status, prestige, or gain at the expense of others or of the organization." Communication. Listening openly and sending convincing messages. People with this competence are effective in give and take, registering emotional cues in attuning their message. Deal with difficult issues straightforwardly. Listen well, seek mutual understanding, and welcome sharing of information fully. Foster open communication and stay receptive to bad news as well as good. For Bill Gates at Microsoft, it's an email address. For Martin Edelstein, president of the Boardroom Incorporated, it's an old-fashioned suggestion box. And for Jerry Kalov, CEO of Cobra Electronics, it's a phone extension known only to his employees. Any call on that confidential number is a priority. He picks it up whenever it rings. Each of these conduits of communication represents one way of resolving every boss's dilemma. Are they telling me only what they want me to hear instead of what I need to know? Kalov got the idea for his phone line long before he became an executive. Very often I had things I wanted to say, but my immediate boss didn't let me, because he wanted to take the credit, Kalov remembers. Or maybe he didn't agree with it. So I felt like I had good ideas or things to say, but I couldn't get through. Who knows where the next brilliant idea is going to come from? The phone line, Kalov adds, works better than management by walking around, because people may be intimidated to be seen talking to the chief executive, or may be too shy even to approach him. The phone line offers discretion and confidentiality, which adds to open, even daring, communication. Such open channels pay. A note in Edelston's suggestion box from a low-level employee, someone who ordinarily would never speak to him, saved the company $500,000 a year. The suggestion from a shipping clerk was to keep company mailings under a 4-pound postal rate limit. By reducing by 1/8 the size of the books the company mailed out, the cumulative savings were hugely significant. Creating an atmosphere of openness is not a trivial gesture. The biggest single complaint of American workers is poor communication with management. 2/3 say it prevents them from doing their best work. I'd say you're unlocking the value of a person when you communicate openly with them, Mark Lohr, a managing director at Solomon Smith Barney, observed to me. When you communicate openly, you open the possibility of getting the best out of people, their energy, creativity. If you don't, then they just feel like cogs in a machine, trapped and unhappy. Mood and meaning. My boss withholds her emotions, an advertising account manager at a $2 billion a year media company complains to me. She never praises anything I do. I just convinced a really big account to go from around $300,000 a year in billings to almost double that. Her response when I told her wasn't, "You did a great job," but, "Sure they took your offer. It's a great deal." There was no feeling whatsoever in her voice, no warmth or enthusiasm. Then she just walked away. When I told other sales managers about my coup, they complimented me. It was the biggest sale I've ever made, and my boss just didn't acknowledge all the work I'd done to get the deal. The account manager continues, "I started to feel that something must be wrong with me, but lots of other people feel the same about her. She never shows any positive feelings or gives any encouragement. Not with little things, not with big things. Our team is productive, but there's no sense of any bond with her." Being an adept communicator is the keystone of all social skills. Among managers, communications competence strongly distinguishes star performers from average or poor ones. The lack of this ability, as seen in the account manager's boss, can torpedo morale. Listening well, the key to empathy, is also crucial to competence in communicating. Listening skills, asking astute questions, being open-minded and understanding, not interrupting, seeking suggestions, account for about 1/3 of people's evaluations of whether someone they work with is an effective communicator. Understandably, listening is among the most frequently taught business skills. Being in control of our own moods is also essential to good communication. A study of 130 executives and managers found that how well people handled their own emotions determined the degree to which those around them preferred to deal with them. In dealing with peers and subordinates, calm and patience were key. Bosses likewise preferred dealing with employees who were not overly aggressive with them. It doesn't matter what mood we're in. The challenge is to stay cool and collected. Aiming for a neutral mood is the best strategy in anticipation of dealing with someone else, if only because it makes us an emotional clean slate and allows us to adapt to whatever the situation calls for. It's like putting a car into neutral so that you can more readily shift into reverse, low or high gear, as the emotional terrain demands. A neutral mood leaves us ready to be more fully involved, present rather than emotionally removed. Keeping cool. Being caught up in a strong, consuming mood is a roadblock to smooth interaction. If we enter into a conversation while preoccupied by a strong mood, the other person is likely to experience us as being unavailable, or what the sociologist Irving Goffman has called away, just going through the motions of the conversation while obviously distracted. The ability to keep cool helps us to put preoccupations aside for the time being, staying flexible in our own emotional responses. This trait is admired worldwide, even in cultures that prefer agitation over calm in certain situations. People who can stay collected in an